freaking auto!
This is Brock and Salk.
Brock Huard is my hero.
What Brock Huard says? No, he's not a friend.
Subscribe to receive every episode at Apple Podcasts or on Google Podcasts.
Ah, we stink, man.
Now, here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
No way!
All right, we'll try to keep this quick, because I'm sure you just can't wait to get to Herm. That's how I would be if I were you.
I can't wait to get to Herm.
All right. Easy, howdy.
I love Herm.
I do too, but you don't need to make it seem like you want to just skip over the beginning and just ditch us to get to Herm. You don't have to be a jerk about
Herm
it.
Herm is really good, okay?
He is.
He's really good.
He is, and I couldn't think of anybody I would rather talk to or hear from today than Herm, so I am very much looking forward to that, Brock. We talked about it last week, of just sort of, you keep seeing it in emails and things people say, because it almost feels impossible to start a work email without commenting on how everyone's doing in the times that we're living in, but I guess I'll repeat it. I never thought I would live through times like this. And I just, the 60s is all I have to compare it to. I always thought that was something that was in the past, that life would be generally boring. Maybe that's the word. I don't know what the right phrase is for it, but that I would just never live through unrest or change or anything quite of this nature. Mm-hmm. Gen X had a reputation for being not particularly politically motivated throughout the 90s. Not that important things weren't happening in politics, and not that it wasn't divisive then, but it seemed to be on the back burner compared to the way things are now, and protests and stuff like that. It just wasn't the same level of passion about it. So yeah. I don't know. I guess I figured that was the way things would be forever, and it didn't occur to me that passion would get stoked again like it was, I don't know, somewhere between 5 and 10 years ago, and that it would crescendo, I hope. I mean, maybe it's going to be, maybe we're not at the crescendo yet, but that it would lead to the times that we're in right now. I just never expected it.
On the heels of, by the way, a pandemic, on the heels of where your entire life was and everything you thought you controlled. And I remember a young Mike Salk at that time in March screaming, like, this virus, it's the enemy of everything that I am.
I still hate it.
It tests my faith. It tests my ability to meet and socialize and the social capital.
It's still doing all those things.
Yeah. So
I still hate it. I'll tell you, man, they opened King County for phase 1.5 this past weekend. And I was like, all right, we can go to some restaurants, 25%. Okay, fine. Like, oh, none of them are open yet. It's like Heather and I driving around the city. Like, where is there an open restaurant?
Someone serve me a dish. I just want a dish.
Right. And I found, like, okay, it's mostly a lot of fast casual restaurants that opened right away, or some of the coffee shops. And we went to a little place by our house with open air seating and stuff like that. I was like, man, I thought that everything would just instantly poof, be open. It's not.
Nope. It is not. So, yes, you throw the emotion.
Is it open where you are? You're so far away. Oh. You can't possibly be in King County, Brock, right?
What do you mean?
What county are you in?
I'm in Spokane County.
You're an unincorporated. Do whatever you want. It's lawless country out there.
I'm an unincorporated Spokane County out here.
Are there restaurants open where you are? Can I come visit you? Howdy, you're in Snohomish County, so you're in phase two. Did things open there?
Oh, yeah. Everything's opening up like crazy. Yeah.
We're just have to move up to Canada.
Go have a meal with Howdy up there,
Salky. It's not that bad.
We'll get our hair cut at the barber shop right down the street, and then we'll go get some McDonald's. It'll be wonderful.
It's not that bad. Things aren't good. I'm not wild about it, but it's not bad enough to go have a meal with Howdy.
Yeah, it is, no question. Just times unlike I think any of us ever saw coming. No. As we sat there in January and February, and even as we taped in March, and to see just the passion, to see the unrest, to see the hurt, to see, I think, some positives, Mike, that have come out since we taped last week, and positives within the professional athlete community, the college athlete community, the voices that are being heard. I think people that are being listened to in ways that weren't a month ago, that weren't 6 months ago, that weren't 5 years ago. And yeah, I mean, just very, very different times.
Well, let's start with that then. I have some questions for you that I kind of want us to discuss together, but let's start there. And in the sports world, the two big stories were Roger Goodell and Drew Brees, both reversing their stance. And in Drew's case, it took a couple of iterations before he got there. In Roger Goodell's case, I mean, it was a video that he put out. They are now both viewing the Kaepernick protests differently. Do you think that that will change the way others view those protests?
I think so. I think there will be much more empathy.
Does it change it for you?
It does. It is. I have much, much more empathy than I would have going back and listening to kind of what we shared at that point. I think you and I were on a somewhat similar page at that point, trying to understand what the message was, trying to understand how the flag and kneeling for the anthem related to that and how all that worked together. I think it was confusing at times, I'll just speak for myself then. And now there is massive amount more empathy. You know, we talked about that a bit a week ago, that when you see it, and there's no denying it, it is you see that level of hatred and evil and racism. When you see that, and you see that in that cop's eyes as he took the life of George Floyd right out of him, you have to have, I would hope, a conscience, a level of compassion, a level of empathy. That it, you know, when you see it, it changes it. And I'm not afraid to say that it further, I think it gave me further empathy for what so many of those have felt and endured. And, you know, I think more compassion to listen and try to be a much better listener, Mike.
I think there's a lot to that. And you know, I remember at the time agreeing with Kaepernick, but being concerned that his message would be lost because of the way he was protesting. And being worried that because of the way people protect the flag and condemn anything that comes near it without pausing to listen to what is being said, that maybe it was a mistake that he was making. And I would agree, if I looked at it now, I think I was wrong. I mean, I think we have to look now at the role he played in change, and that maybe it was more significant and that he was actually having more success than it seemed like in the moment. And yeah, if I changed the conversation to talk about the flag rather, or about his methods rather than his message, shame on me. You know, I'm sorry about that. And I think I always respected the message he was trying to portray, but if I let the means distract from that, then that was a mistake. And I'm certainly not above saying that. Roger Goodell is obviously in a position of great power, right? I mean, in the sports world, is he the most powerful person? He's certainly on the list. Like what?
In our country.
Him and Scott Boras?
Probably in our country.
Are they one and
Adam
two?
Adam Silver's pretty far up there.
Yeah, that's true. Silver's going to be up there. I mean, there's a bunch of people who'll be on the list, but certainly you couldn't have that list without putting Goodell.
I mean, Gary Bettman.
Obviously. Yeah. Without putting Goodell in the
Bud
conversation.
Seedling.
But I don't think Bud's on the list anymore, necessarily. I think Rob Bud's
Manfred.
Off the hook at this point.
Yeah, Robbie Manfred.
Look,
yeah.
Roger Goodell's always been a follower, Brock. That's what he is. He's not a leader. He's a follower. And he has always followed to where safe ground is. Does that make sense?
Well, I'm going to say he's an arbiter. I don't know if it's fair to someone that has elevated to that place as an attorney first. And I think he has been an arbiter most of his life.
I don't know, man. I think I don't know. I think he follows.
He follows the lead of the 32 men that pay him.
Yes,
I think
he's
got to arbitrate all the issues that come between.
But he's also asked to lead them a little bit.
Isn't
he also asked to lead the league and lead them into new directions? And he does some of that, obviously, in terms of marketing, things like that. But when it comes to standing up for what might be right, I'm not sure he has generally been a leader. I think he's tended to follow and waited until there has been safe ground and then said, okay, it's now safe to go there. And I guess I'm speaking more about domestic violence, where he was absent for years until finally there was enough of a groundswell to make him move off of the spot that he seemed determined to stay on. And eventually he did, and he moved off that spot. And I think the league has done significantly better in that regard in the last 5 years. It's not perfect, but I would commend their efforts and say that they are doing a significantly better job. And a couple of years ago when Kaepernick came out, I think he was comfortable not listening, because that was the safe thing to do then. It would have shown great leadership to listen. It would have shown great leadership to support. It might have been hard. It might have been difficult. It might have received some backlash. But I think it would have been a great time for him to show that level of leadership, and he didn't. I'm glad he's doing it now. I think that some good may come of it. quite frankly, I think a lot of good could come of it. And I think there's that he's capable, as we've seen, of facilitating good work. But I find it hard to believe it'll happen because of him.
Yeah, I guess all the way along, I would ask you there, just how much can he lead those 32 other multi-billionaires?
It's a good question. Maybe I'd be more comfortable with the word facilitator than arbiter. Yes. I don't know that he's an arbiter. Maybe he's a facilitator.
I think he's an arbiter that tries to hug players on one side and love them on one side on the stage when they're drafted in the first round, and then try to listen to 32 owners that have, at times, very opposing views that come from a very different generation. That, you know, even 10 years ago, I think some of the ownership in the league and some of the louder voices in the league are not the same ones today. I think we've seen that grow. Facilitators probably, I mean, we're just kind of semantics a little bit between arbitrating and facilitating, but I don't know if he has ever been, this is my league, this is my show, this is how I run
it. He's not David Stern.
Well, he's kind of like the Queen of England in some ways. Like, he's just standing there and everyone's saying, this is the guy in charge. And if he wanted to, he could do something. But in reality, he's just the face for things.
I guess I'm disappointed if that's true, which I don't necessarily think it is. I guess that would disappoint me. I think he has the chance, and we've seen it through David Stern and Adam Silver, what leadership can look. I think Adam Silver's a heck of a leader. I think he leads the way, right? And Brock, if it's really just being an arbiter or a go-between or a mediator between owners and players, well, Adam Silver is sure finding a way to make that a more even deal than Roger Goodell, who's always, I think, had his bread buttered on the side of the owners almost entirely. So yeah, there are ways to lead other than his way.
Yeah. I mean, the players in the NBA run that league, right? They make infinitely more than the coaches, and some of them may make generational wealth that they can be future owners sooner rather than later. And I think there's a little different dynamics going on.
They run the league more than the coaches and GMs do.
But what's that?
The players in the NBA run the league more than the coaches and GMs do. I agree with that.
Yes.
I don't know that they do more than the owners do, though. And in that way, I think Adam Silver shows what leadership can look like. And, I'm not necessarily their biggest fan as a league. I don't love the way the game has gone. But yeah. I got a lot of respect for Adam Silver specifically and what he's done to, A, make his league relevant, and B, walk that line and actually lead conversations instead of being late to the party. So, look, I'm glad Roger Goodell got here. The same way I'm glad Drew Brees ended up getting to where he was. I was really wondering what the New Orleans Saints were going to look like this year, whether or not they were going to be able to have a team.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, obviously they'd have to play a game, but could they be an actual team?
Yeah, and I think we talked last week, and I said, or at least I know I did with Danny and Paul last week after that happened. I said there will absolutely be reclamation out of that. Those guys, Malcolm and Drew and Mike, they're going to get together, and they will. They will have to. I think Drew's got a leader. I think he's done it for a couple decades. I think he's poured into that community. I think he's given his life to live there, and I think he's got a substantial background in that community, and he needed to sit and be with his teammates. He's the Mike Salk. He needs people. He needs teammates. He needs not to be on some Yahoo interview and, absent of his teammates. He needed to get in that room and he needed to hear and he needed to feel the pain and the emotion and the heartache and what it means and his messaging and the power behind it. Mm-hmm. And it didn't surprise me at all to see him come back after spending those hours and healing those wounds. And, I think that there's going to be great fruit born out of that adversity.
I think so too.
Because I'm sure Herm's going to speak to some of this, that you got to be willing to have, and that's the beauty of an NFL locker room, man. It is so much. And you hear this all the time from former players, right? You can never get that locker room experience again. That is true to an extent of 53 in an NFL locker room or 100 in a college. And, we have differences. We had our own little locker room of 4 or 5. And, I had spent a lifetime with guys from the South, guys from the West, guys from the inner city. I had not spent any time in my life with a Northeast elite academic liberal. That's one thing I had not until I got into a locker room there in that building with you and similarly had to hash out differences.
Well, I appreciate you calling me elite. That was nice.
Thank you. Did you like that?
I appreciate that. I'm glad you recognize my elitism.
Is that fair or not fair?
No, it is. I've been reading a lot about privilege and what it means. Of course, I come from a privileged background.
Well, Pete said that from day one.
Pete recognized it immediately.
Pete, you bristled.
Pete got right to the core of who I was on that.
Oh, where are you from? Oh, okay. Oh,
Silver Spoon. That was a great moment for everybody.
Was that on air, by the way?
Oh, yeah.
Off air?
Yeah, that was on air. Yeah. It was
not
a great moment for
you
anybody.
Bet it was.
And look, and I do still object to the idea of assuming you know anybody's full history because of the town they grew up in. I think that's not a great way to play things in life.
Right.
And I think Pete knew what he was doing and was he and I weren't in a great spot.
Oh,
at the
Silver
time.
Spoon. Oh, slogans. Oh, right. Silver Spoon.
Okay,
oh,
that's
slogans.
Fine. And but fine. But I recognize a lot of the privilege that I come from. I recognize that I come from an immense number of advantages that most of the country or the world does not get. So yeah, I don't mind those labels. They don't bother me. I'm proud of who I am. I'm proud of what I've done, but I also recognize that a lot of it was luck, right? I mean, luck being born into the family I was born into, luck being born into, you know, the level of wealth that I grew up with, luck in terms of
the patience of Jane and
Larry,
and,
for sure.
And Larry to put
especially
up with an
Jane,
anthrax living, boomboxing, yeah. Angry, love the
Larry
Lakers, live in Boston.
Patience, yeah, to be clear, it's mostly Jane with the patience. But look, I recognize that I was incredibly lucky, and some of it was that, some of it was right place at the right time, and falling into this industry, and you know, getting you know the station going under, and losing my job in Boston just as they were launching 710 in Seattle. I mean, those are. You can't plan for that.
Yeah.
Right. I'm proud of the hard work. I'm proud of what I've done. And I would assume that you feel similarly, that you worked your butt off to get to where you were. But also, you in some ways, you won the gene pool lottery. I mean, both those things can be true at the same time.
Yeah. I had, Grandpa Mike would always say Grandma Peg's height was an amazing gift. There's no question about that. And her compassion and her love with Coach Mike's just insane love for and passion for football, and growing up in that home amongst a bunch of, competitive brothers and competitive football players and all of those thousands of hours we talk about with Malcolm Gladwell, right? In that book. In that outlier book, and you know, just the fortuitous benefit and blessing, and then you know, capitalizing and going for it and making the most of it.
And without making this a political conversation, we'll bring it back to Drew Brees here in a moment.
Yes.
I think that's one of the things that can be hard for folks to hear is that multiple things can be true at once.
Yes,
and that by recognizing some of the luck and privilege that you've received, it doesn't mean that you didn't also work hard to take advantage of the situation. Both things can be true.
Yep.
And I think that tends to get lost when people want to debate things and get into, and look, we're not a political show. No, you're not tuning in to hear my views on race relations in the country. That's not why we're here. I understand that. But I think it is fair to talk about the need to, when listening, be able to accept that multiple things can be true at the same time.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I've always been great about that. I'm learning more about it. I'm trying to listen more, and I don't think I'm alone, and I don't pat myself in the back for that. That's what I'm doing right now. And I think others are also. I think we need to find ways to recognize where we got lucky, understand what that's done for us and how it means other people may not be as lucky, but then also be okay with knowing that we also did well at the chances we got. Those things can both be true.
Yeah, and the beauty, I think, of my 44 years to this point is just the opportunity, Mike, to see lots of those different paths.
I'm sure.
Right? To get from a smaller town environment when we grew up in Puyallup at that point and, you know, all blue collar and largely all white, and to get to the University of Washington and see that horizon grow immensely. Mm. And I remember even the first day of school at the UW. I don't know if I shared this with you before, but, you know, we were a quarter school. So we were on campus practicing football. As a freshman, I was actually there in June for something called Leap Year and something that still exists. And even now, many freshmen, like my nephew, hope to get there on campus in January and immediately jump into winter training and then have spring ball and all of that. Well, at that time, we had a leap year, so we had about 20 students in the class, and it wasn't all athletes. It was just kind of a get ready to go to school, and then it was just football from August till the end of September. And then the first day of school, living in Haggett Hall and going to class, and I remember going into the hub on campus at the UW, and I don't know if there's been a dozen times where you just get that sweat down your rib cage where you're like, oh my gosh, what did I just step into? It was massive. It was foreign language. It was culture. It was diversity, unlike anything I had ever experienced in all my life. And just not a panic attack, but overwhelmed. Overwhelmed at the size, at the magnitude, at the diversity, at the language, at all of it. Like almost just stuck watching, you know, some of those commercials where you see just live zooming by. Like, yeah. Oh, there's no way I'm going to handle that. Well, like, how in the world am I going to live it? So what?
It's funny. I imagine you going through that at 18, right? And experiencing something completely different and new and all that. And then to spin it all the way forward to this past week and think about Drew Brees at, what is he, 41 years old or whatever Drew Brees is, certainly close to that, to and having been around people of all kinds of ethnicities for as long as he has, and to have led locker rooms as successfully as he has up to winning a Super Bowl, right? And being around players that are incredibly vocal too. I mean, you know, some of the guys that he's played with are among the more vocal African American leaders in the NFL community. And to still have his mind changed and blown at that age and at that experience level, I think speaks to just how powerful some of these changes could be.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, and you know, to be able to listen, truly listen to those teammates. And that skill is dissipating in America more than anything else.
And I think if Drew Brees can do it, there are going to be a lot of other people who don't have an excuse. If Drew Brees and everything that he's accomplished, if he can truly listen, what's your excuse, right? I mean, what's my excuse? What's anybody's excuse if Drew Brees is willing to do that? And by the way, take fire and shoot back at the president. I mean, like, as a consequence of his, and I'm not making this political, I'm just talking to the what the consequences are to saying what he said, and to be willing to listen despite all of that in the public eye and everything else, I think it erases a lot of excuses anybody could make.
Yeah, and being able to listen on both sides. Yeah. And I think for his teammates, you know, I bet you that Malcolm came out of that meeting as well and learned a little bit more about Drew. Right. And he had not been teammates for 15 years with him. Right. He competed against him. He'd been in Pro Bowls with him and everything else. But I think that learning has to go both ways. Mm-hmm. You know, it just as it's often done with you and I, Salk, over 10 years, is that, you know, maybe not in that moment do I take in everything that you're saying and do I buy necessarily all of it. And there's still ideology that you and I see very differently, you know, and politically very differently. But being able to have that exchange, can we have that exchange? And those exchanges go on in locker rooms. Right. And I know Vic Fangio took a ton of heat over the last week, the coach for the Broncos.
Deservedly, I think. And I'll admit, I'm surprised he still has a job.
Really?
Yeah. I'm surprised. I'm not saying that I don't know whether I would have fired him or not. I might have. But I'm surprised he has a job.
And I would hope. And as he gathered, and I was listening to an interview of one of their safeties, Simmons, I think earlier this week on Golic and Wingo, and he's talking about the Zoom call that he had and number of the conversations that Vic has had with players. And I think Vic is saying, like, we have 90 guys and it turns into 53, and I want the very best for those 53, and I'm going to take the best 53 no matter size, shape, background, color, that can help me win and help us win. And that those are the blinders that I guess, you know, I wasn't shocked to hear from an old coach, because Mike, that's a different generation of coaching. Well, and of coaches, but not
that,
right.
But that's part of my reason why I'm surprised he still has a job, is that I'm surprised he didn't look at it and say, yeah, Vic Fangio isn't such a great coach that he needs to, that everyone's going to give him such a long leash. Like,
he hasn't won 5 Super Bowls.
He's not anything. And so the moment I figured, you know, he'd get fired just kind of based on it's not worth the headache. Yeah. But I also think it's a, you know, he, I hope he learns from it. I hope he really is open to thinking about what else has happened and what other people's experiences might be in the league.
Yep.
And I guess that's kind of what we were talking about when it comes to privilege and luck and your own experience, not necessarily being the same path that other people travel. So yes. For him to say there's no racism in the league, I don't know how he could know that.
Yeah.
That just doesn't make sense. Like, well, yeah. Okay, maybe that you see. And by the way, I've made the same mistake at times. I mean, I've been questioned before about, hell, well, you're from Boston, and Boston's the most racist city, and Torrey Hunter said this, and the black athletes don't want to play there for these reasons. And I've always said that's not my experience there. I don't see that. But clearly it's been happening, and it's not up to me to defend because it's not my experience there. Well, so what? I have one very small, as you mentioned, liberal elite experience there in Boston. I don't know what else is happening. I don't know the shoes that Torrey Hunter walks in when he walks into Fenway Park. So I think it's Vic Fangio probably, I would guess, has done a lot of listening here in the last week or so also.
Yes. And I hope a lot of learning, and I hope then a lot of leading. I think those are the words that I've heard a number of different times expressed in a number of different ways from lots of people with lots of different experiences of mine. But can you listen? And then can you learn? Because it's one thing just to listen, and a listen is a step ahead of hearing. Hearing, you're not really taking it in. Listening, you're actually an active listener. Then you hope to learn and have compassion and have empathy and really learn from one another in a healthy exchange back and forth. And then ultimately, can you lead to some change? You know, in the position that you're in as a player, the position you're in as a radio host, the position you're in as a coach, the position you're in as a producer, can you actually help to lead and facilitate some change there? So I think those are, you know, as we're all taking this in for the last 2 to 3 weeks, and we will for the weeks and the months ahead as we push into these sports seasons that will hopefully begin with the NBA and hopefully Major League Baseball, that, you know, that's the trend line that I would love to see. I'd love to see the listening. I'd love to see the learning. And then I would love to see just fruit, actual leading coming out of it. And, you know, that I think is the opportunity these players in the sports world, and certainly I think the coaches as well, have.
Brock, I will admit I'm a little worried about doing this because now that this is a podcast instead of a daily show, right, it's supposed to have the tone of a podcast. You know, radio shows are all about energy and excitement, and podcasts are supposed to be, I don't know, thought-provoking and quiet and calm or something. So are we allowed to have Herm on with all of the energy that Herm Edwards brings to any appearance he's ever been on? I don't.
Well, Michael, what we do in the podcast world is we call him Herman.
Oh, now he's Herman.
Yes, this is now Herman Edwards.
Let's welcome in Herman Edwards.
Oh, boy.
Professor of football studies at Arizona State University and friend of this show. Herman, how are you?
I am well, and hopefully all the good folks up in Seattle are well. And you guys especially. So thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Jokes aside, I mean, it's not been a time for joking recently between the pandemic and then what's been happening around the country here for the last week or so. What have these last few weeks been like for you?
Well, when we start thinking about the pandemic, it's something that has taken its life of its own, really. And you watched an entire country and really a world shut down completely. The new norm is different than it has been. And I think some people are having trouble with that, which, you know, is kind of interesting. Now all of a sudden it's kind of opened back up, and I think we'll see how we handle this. And with that being said, then you see, what is taking place all over the country. And not so much just all over the country, but all over the world, but here in America, with the protests, what is taking place. And it kind of, for me, because I've been involved in this movie before. I watched this movie in 1968 when I was 14 years old with my father. And now I'm watching the same movie 52 years later with my daughters. And they're asking me the same questions I was asking my dad. So that's kind of interesting. But I think there's a difference in this one compared to in the 60s. And I grew up in the 60s and was involved in all that and social, you know, unrest and protests all over the country. And when you go to Cal Berkeley as a freshman in 1972, you kind of see it all, you know, you get eyeful. But with that being said, I think this is a little bit different. This reminds me of Rosa Parks. If you know the story of Rosa Parks, one day after coming from work in Alabama in 1955, she generally caught the bus. Her place was on the back of the bus. And for some odd reason, that one day she was tired. She was just flat tired. And she says, I'm not going to the back. I'm tired. I'm going to sit in the front. That's America right now. Mm. America is tired. We're tired of what we've been witnessing. And what I see in the difference between the 60s and right now, the people that are protesting, all shapes, all sizes, all colors, all different religions. America is fed up. And it has taken to the streets, and their voices want to be heard. And I think the thing I realize about protesting, whether it's social injustice, just people's rights in general, is that the change doesn't occur in 2 days. This is a change for their children, for their children, because that the change is long. It is hard, and it's fascinating to watch for me because I'm 66 years old now. And I've seen the kind of development of this, kind of where it's gone. And America finally got fed up and said, enough is enough.
Tell me, Herm, about the conversations that you're having with your daughters. And if you could let me in a little bit on those conversations you're having with 100 or so sons of yours that you're called to lead at Arizona State.
Yeah, we had a big one yesterday with the players. We were on Zoom and we talked about them having a platform and to make sure that if they got on this platform and wanted to talk about social injustice, that their words were encouraging, but also their words had solutions. You know, don't be a part of the problem. You know, be part of a solution. And it starts with a conversation. This is what's so great about football, is that we all form this huddle in different backgrounds, different religions, different colors of people come in this huddle. And we're kind of unique in the fact that we're in this bubble our whole life. We're in athletics because we share our differences, but we find a way to play with each other so we can have success. And when you think about America and certain forms of it, we don't huddle enough. We don't get in the huddle. And the huddle has to consist of this. You know, change is made and knowledge is made by the people in your circle. Who influences you? Who are your influences in your life? And then what do they look like? Do they all look like you? Because if they do, then you're hearing from one side. But when you have a rainbow of influencers that you have these conversations with, this is how you gain knowledge and this is how you change. So that's kind of unique. My daughters, at 14 years old, they're two little black girls, and you know they're searching for kind of they know who they are, and they're wondering why does this take place and why are they doing this, and that's a conversation that you have with your children, and I think those conversations, regardless of who you are in America, those are the suppertime conversations. You know, right is right. Right doesn't have a color. Right is just right. And wrong is wrong. And it doesn't matter who you are, what you look like. Just do the right thing. You know, treat people how you want to be treated. And, you know, that's the kind of conversation you got to have.
I think one of the things that has been challenging, or maybe that's not the right word, but interesting about these protests and the conversation that has sprung up around them is that unlike what I was taught in school, I'm 42, so I'm a Gen Xer. Unlike what I was taught in school, this doesn't seem to be, the protests aren't about bigotry, and they don't feel there is much about what's in people's heart or hatred or anything like that. They seem to be focusing, at least here in Seattle, more on the systems, more on systems that are put in place, whether they're on purpose or even just passively by accident. In some ways, I think it makes the conversation easier, but in other ways, it makes it harder because we're being asked to not just look at how we feel, but actually in what we allow around us to take place. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, and you think about the systems when they're in place. This is why I say who are the influencers in your life? Because as you create these systems to live by, or whatever it may be, whatever system you're using, do you have a multitude of people that come from different walks of life and different opinions when you make decisions? Because if you don't have that, it's not truly a system. The system should be to benefit everyone. That's what makes, you know, athletics so good, in the fact that there's a balanced playing field. There's a level playing field. You know, when you think of Lady Justice, right? She's blindfolded, by the way. She has a sword in her hand, you know, she's blindfolded. and she has these two scales that are supposed to be balanced. Well, that's not true for people of color for a long time. That scale was not balanced at times when decisions are made. And then that's another part of this protest. Because when you think about it, she's blind for a reason. She doesn't see color or power or religion. It's supposed to be on justice. Well, when it's not handed out equally or fairly, then something's wrong. And well, you know, and you can say, well, and I've said this many a time, whether it's the police, well, you know, people that run the police departments, they're not teaching bad policing, but you can't allow it to happen either. And when it happens, there have to be consequences. There have to be consequences. Mm. That's how it works. That's how it should work anyway.
So, Herm, who's in your circle? I know you're 66. You've experienced it. You've joined us many times over the 10 years of sharing your life experience of being on that campus. You and I did an Above and Beyond podcast, which was a blast. But at this stage of the game, you still have a circle. You still have a group of friends. You still have people you're learning from, other coaches. What have those conversations been like over the last few months as you finally will now get a chance to lead these young men again?
Well, I think my circle has been touched by a lot of great men, and a lot of those happen to be in the field that I've participated in my whole life in sports, for the most part. You know, those are the influences on my life, along with my parents, obviously. But I think through that you gain so much knowledge, because everything we've actually learned in our life, we've actually learned from someone else. And now I have the ability, as a coach, to talk to young men, and the conversation was pretty deep yesterday. In the fact that, look, this thing is about your children. You're going to be fathers. You want to make this thing better for your kids. So understand that. You know, this is not, you know, that's what this movement's all about. It's like pushing this big boulder. You don't just push it off the road. I mean, it's going to take some time to push. But these are the things that you got to look at. You know, you just can't say, "Well, I'm a football player and I'm an athlete." You can do that, but you're going to be a father one day. You're going to be a husband. You're going to work in your community. You know, everyone's not going to be a pro football player. I mean, you're going to get on with your life's work. The people that you touch when you go to work and the conversations you have, you know, that's influential for some people.
So you mentioned having a variety of people around you, and I think that's a great. It's a great thought and a great piece of advice, and certainly it's true in football locker rooms. And if we move this conversation to the NFL and maybe to the more specific of what we saw in the past week or so with Drew Brees and the New Orleans Saints, how would you handle something? I mean, if you were in Sean Payton's shoes, how do you handle something like the story and situation that developed with Drew Brees and his teammates over the past week?
Well, Drew Brees, I think, like many in America, they misinterpreted the message of Colin Kaepernick. That message got hijacked early. I was at ESPN when it all happened. And I just said, the media is going to turn this thing, and whoever the people are. And now social media is so big that they have their own platform, and people flipped the narrative where it was about the flag and the military. It was not. They never listened to the message. Okay? And so when Drew Brees and his brain, for some reason, I don't know, and Drew's a, you know, good guy. I mean, he interpreted it that way, and it was never intended to be that way. And he's a man, because he stood up and said, "Hey, I made a mistake. you know, and I got to look at it different. And it's kind of funny, guys, because as we're having this conversation, I've had a lot of guys that I've been involved with my whole life, men my age and some younger, and not all black guys. And I've gotten a lot of phone calls, and they're asking me, like, what do I do? Right? How do I never looked at it that way. And here again, if your circle is not a circle of people that don't look like you, then all you know is one way. It's just no one way. And if other things, that they don't affect you, it doesn't affect the circle or the influences that you're in, then you're kind of like, it's not a big deal. I think America now is at a point to where it doesn't matter anymore. It's like, this is not right. We got to fix this. And we're not fixing it. I'm not fixing it for me. I'm trying to fix it for my kids when they have kids.
Herm, I think one of the more resounding messages that I have heard over the last couple of weeks is the ability to listen. You know, that we need to be able to listen to those that are different than us, those who do come from different backgrounds, as you've hit on a number of different times. How do you do that? How do you equip and train your coaches around you to listen? How do you equip and train these student athletes to listen? What are the best practices to go in about listening so you can actually learn and not just hear the message?
Well, I think our problem with not being able to listen is that we feel like we have all the answers and we don't. It becomes a debate. You know, it's like at ESPN, right? Everything has to be a debate. We don't do enough listening because we all feel like we know, or we take, or this conversation is a hard one to listen to. It's like this. I don't want to go down that road. Well, okay. And they cut it off, right? They end the conversation because this is a hard conversation to have. And I just think, you know, as we grow in life, we have to understand that, that these are the conversations, if we truly want change, have to take place, and they're uncomfortable. And that's okay. Because it's okay to be uncomfortable. But the only way you can truly gain knowledge is to listen. You got to be a good listener. And that's hard, like you say. It's hard.
How about the leagues? I mean, the NFL, the NCAA, other leagues as well. I mean, you talk about, and I'm with Brock, the idea of listening comes first. And, you know, I'm not necessarily Roger Goodell's biggest fan, quite the opposite. But I thought what he said in his video the other day was, I don't know that Roger Goodell's a leader. I think he's more of a follower. But I thought that he showed some level of ability to listen and change his mind and be open-minded. And I'm hopeful that that will lead to some level of change for his league. What can the leagues do? What kind of action steps can the NCAA, or if you don't feel comfortable talking about that, the NFL or any Major League Baseball, if they ever get their stuff figured out, what can they do?
Who's in their circle of influence? We all are influenced by people. And who is in the circle? And when you think about the NFL, who is in the circle of power in the NFL? There's no owners that look like me, right? How many GMs look like me? Two. How many head coaches? Three. How many pro directors? How many college directors? How many trainers? How many in Park Avenue? Who works there? Who does Roger get influenced by? I mean, obviously, when the Colin Kaepernick thing came up, he didn't have anybody talking to him because he missed the message as well, right? So, I mean, I'm not saying it's his fault. I'm just saying we get comfortable with the people that maybe share the same ideas we have. Or maybe we don't want to get in a conversation with people that make us uncomfortable, so we don't allow them to be in that circle when decisions are being made. Well, if that stands true, you can't change. Because then you're really not listening, are you? You're really not listening. And so, look, guys, I came into the National Football League in 1977. Listen to this now. 1977, not 1957. 1977 as a rookie. There was 28 teams. There were only eight black coaches in the whole league in 1977. Think about that. Not 1957, 1977. You look at the field now, the players on the field. If you don't have black players, you don't have a league. It was not that way when I came in the league. There were certain positions that basically they asked you to change your position if you were going to play that because you played it in college. That's not required anymore. It's a level playing field, and you can compete for any position you want now. That part of the NFL has grown. Behind the doors and behind the buildings, the people that make all decisions, that hasn't grown enough yet.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if that can work long term, Herman. That's one of the questions I had written down for you ahead of time, is can a system in sports work with as many black players there are, let's say predominantly black players, but with predominantly white coaches? I mean, over a long period of time, maybe not even a long period of time, can that function?
Well, it's functioned so far in America. Think about high school coaches, college coaches.
Sure.
I mean, look at the Pac-12. Now, the Pac-12 was pretty aggressive, right? There's five coaches of color that are head coaches in the Pac-12. Look at all the Power Five schools. How many do you see? Not many, man. And that's those, and you know, and remember, college football is the lifeblood of the NFL. You draft players from college football. Well, if you're going to give coaches an opportunity to be professional coaches, what do they look like if you're getting them from college football? How many coordinators are there? How many head coaches are there? I mean, ask yourself that question. Not many.
You have a vision for what this season's going to look like, Herm?
Oh, I think it'll be one of, you might not get all 12 games in. We're anticipating, we're hopeful we're going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, this is not a social distancing sport. And the way you combat the disease without having a vaccine right now is to do what? Social distance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's nothing about the game of football that's been social distancing. And if you have a social distancing team, you ain't winning many games, guys.
Yeah, and I guess I ask you that vision question, Herm, on both the football, right, on the pandemic, and also on the conversation that we've had for the last 20 minutes. Do you have a vision for what this is going to look like in the NFL? Do you have a vision for your players and the platform that they do have and what it's going to look like? So both from a, you know, just a you know, just a raw football standpoint, as you brought up there, and then also just, you know, from a vision for what this could be to continue to influence change.
Well, I think that it's the thing that I've visited with people my age that have watched it from the 60s to right now, it's different. It feels different. It looks different. And I think with conversation and the ability of people to listen, we can make a change for the next generation of young people, for your kids' children. All right? Think of it that way, for your kids' children. And look, this is not utopia. This is not going to be ever perfect. But if we could get some form of balance to it, where the competition is just, it's equal. You get to compete. Look, I've said this many times. This is not black people's problem. This is America's problem. This is the American dream of coming to a place that will give you opportunity if you work hard to compete for whatever you want to do in life. To compete. That's all you ask. You know, I'll speak for myself. As a black man, I never wanted a handout. I never asked for a handout. I just want to have the opportunity to compete at anything I was ever taught to do. That's all I want. And if we do it that way, then it's fair. Then it's fair.
Wasn't there a coach that said you just play to win? What was that? What did that guy say? Play to.
Yeah, somebody said that. That ain't real hard to figure out, is it?
Coach, I got to tell you, I'm a couple things. First of all, I miss you on ESPN. I miss you as a commentator. I miss hearing you. I miss getting to talk to you more often. I miss all of those things. But I just feel so strongly that it's worth it for you to be doing what you're doing and leading young men and all of your life. I just, I don't have boys. They're certainly not college aged, and they're, if they were, they wouldn't be looking to get scholarships to a D1 program like yours. But I would be so proud to have kids of mine learn and play for you. And I'm so happy you're doing what you're doing and making a difference for people.
Well, thank you for saying that, because that becomes your legacy. You know, I was taught at a very young age, the most powerful possession that you own in your lifetime will be your last name. And no one can buy that. And you can't compromise that. And with that being said, as you walk through your life, what have you done for others? Because I don't stand here by myself. I stand here representing all the people that helped me along the way. And that's what you want. You want to be able to help people. And if you can do that, you feel you've fulfilled your life.
Well, Herman, I think that's a perfect way to end it, Mr.
I got to, you know, instead of ending on a nice note, I got to ask a dumb question. I'm sorry. Are you in Arizona now? Because I'm worried about beautiful house your wife built in Carmel and whether or not you're even allowed in from time to time.
My wife is in the kitchen. She's in the kitchen of that beautiful house in Carmel that she constructed. So we're here at home. And I've been doing yard work for the last week, man.
What, do you wake up at 3 in the morning to do yard work?
My wife is killing me. And then she comes back home. You know, her problem is, you know those renovation movie that comes on? I don't know, those two guys that come on, they're always doing things with houses.
Yeah.
You know,
the Property Brothers?
Yes, they're a stuff guy. She goes up in the room, and she starts watching this. She binges it for like 2 hours, right? And then she looks at me and goes, changes, like, stop watching that. I'm going to call these guys and tell them, hey, man, you guys are influencing my wife. You're killing me right now. You're killing me.
You just built the house. Like, she can't possibly be ready to make changes.
She was unbelievable. I said, honey, will you stop already? So I don't know. I'm going to have to work the rest of my life, guys. That's for sure.
We miss you. Thank you so much. Thanks for doing this. And there's a lot of difficult conversations. We're doing our best, and we really appreciate your help.
Thank you so much. Hey, guys, look at me. Look, it takes courage, and both. I respect both of you guys. I love you, too. You know that. It takes courage for what you guys are doing. You guys are on-air personalities. You can easily go away from it and go do something else. And you're right. It's a hard conversation, but it's the right conversation for right now. And I appreciate you guys letting me be involved in it.